This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the MDT podcast. I'm Jo Preston and I'm a geriatrician down in South London at St George's.
And I'm Ian Wilkinson, I'm a geriatrician who works down in Surrey, East Surrey Hospital. And today we're talking about problems with the prostate.
Yes, and we've had help from our faculty members, Edda Hensler, and some guest faculty input from Owen Ingram, who is one of my registrars.
And coming up this week, we are going to have a think about where the prostate is and what its job is. Have a think about the anatomy of the prostate and why it can cause some symptoms, to recognise why urinary symptoms in men, in older men, may be related to the prostate, and to proactively ask about prostatic symptoms in older people. But before we get to all of that, yes, we're going to have a think about social media stuff this week. Jo, do you want to go first? Mm.
So mine was a tweet that I saw on the way here, actually, which is from David Warriner, who is at Dr. David Warriner on Twitter, with a piece from the BMJ that he has kind of clipped and tweeted about what overdiagnosis is, from an article from Kale and Korenstein in the BMJ. So I'm just going to read a little bit of it. It says, overdiagnosis is the diagnosis of a condition that, if unrecognised, would not cause symptoms or harm to a patient during his or her lifetime. The scope of overdiagnosis as a result of services delivered in primary care is unclear. Although the overdiagnosis of indolent breast, prostate, thyroid and lung cancers is all well described, and the overdiagnosis of chronic kidney disease, depression and attention deficit disorders is also recognised. Overdiagnosis can harm patients by leading to overtreatment with the associated potential toxicities, diagnosis-related anxiety and depression, and labelling or through financial burden. Many entrenched factors facilitate overdiagnosis, including the growing use of advanced diagnostic technology, financial incentives, and a medical culture that encourages greater use of tests and treatments, limitations in the evidence that obscure the understanding of diagnostic utility, use of non-beneficial screening tests, and the broadening of disease definitions. Efforts to reduce overdiagnosis are hindered by physicians' and patients' lack of awareness of the problem and by confusion about terminology, with overdiagnosis often conflated with related concepts.
Hmm.
Which I thought was
That's quite nice.
Interesting. And yeah, it kind of fits into some of the stuff we're going to be talking about today as well, but I think something that we should be very conscious of in geriatric medicine. Well, in all medicine, really, but that was nicely worded.
For those of you listening, my one is going to let you into a little secret. And the little secret is we don't record these just before they go out sometimes. Sometimes they're recorded just a little bit before. So, and I have to tell you that because this is a blog article, so you're going to need to know the date to find it. And so this is
although,
a blog article.
We will have it on our website.
Although we will have it on the website, yeah. So I probably didn't need to spoil the illusion. But anyway, so this was on the BGS blog on the 20th of August. And the title of the article is Decisions, 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 How to Assess the Mental Capacity of People with Dementia.
I saw this.
It's nice, isn't it? So this is an article written by Catherine Pennington, who's a Senior Clinical Research Fellow at the Centre for Dementia Prevention in Edinburgh and honorary clinical lecturer at the University of Bristol. She is one of the authors of an article looking at capacity assessment in people with dementia. And essentially, if you're not sure about this whole area, go back and have a listen to our episode on capacity from the earlier series, which you can find them on the website. But essentially, when you're assessing capacity, there are some structured tools that have been developed to try and help you walk through the process to aid the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
But often the tools are aimed at researchers investigating the cognitive building blocks of decision making, but some of the others are designed for use with some specific medical conditions. They take up some sort of from 15 minutes onwards to use, and some are more stringent than what the mental capacity would say you have to do, whereas others are not stringent enough. And so the article, the blog article, basically says that, but links you on to an Age and Ageing article where they go through this in a lot more detail, thinking about the pros and cons of the various different tools available.
Nice.
And I thought it was just nice to provide some structure to the way in which you think about someone's capacity assessment.
which is really important. And although we do often try to do this as much detail as possible, it's nice to have things that can just help to make it a little bit easier, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so back to this episode, and we are talking about the prostate. So we just have one definition this time because we can define it without needing another practical one, I think. So the prostate is a gland that sits at the neck of the bladder surrounding the urethra. It produces prostatic fluid, which is an important component of male semen. It's usually about the size of a walnut. During this episode, we're going to talk about some of the main illnesses or diseases affecting the prostate and how they might present. Now, some of these are related to continence, but we did an episode on continence, I think, in our first or second series. So we are not going to go back into that too much detail. We're going to point you back to listen to that for lots of the incontinence side of things, the bladder side of things. Symptoms related to the prostate are usually due to the local effect on the urethra, so where the bladder empties into the tube out into the outside world because of enlargement of the gland, and often that can cause bladder outflow obstruction.
So the urethra goes through the prostate.
Yes.
So as the prostate enlarges, it can crimp down on the urethra, and that affects the flow of urine through the urethra.
So these are part of a collective group of symptoms called lower urinary tract symptoms, which is just a very descriptive term, which is related to any of the symptoms that involve the bladder and urethra. So it can be caused by any of the organs affecting that, so including overactive bladder. And 30% of men over the age of 65 will have some lower urinary tract symptoms, or LUTs is what they're often referred to as, and you might hear us say that in the rest of the episode. But importantly, not all LUTs are caused by prostate disease, but prostate disease is the commonest cause in men.
Yeah, and I think it's useful sometimes just to think about the sort of questions you may ask, and they'll come up again later on as we talk through. But I think they essentially ask questions about from the moment that people feel the need to go to the loo, and then sort of almost walk them through the process of going to the loo and then leaving the bathroom at the end, and whether or not they need to go back. So kind of walk through that process and ask questions along the way. So the first thing we're going to talk about is probably the commonest thing that affects the prostate is benign prostatic hypertrophy, or enlargement of the prostate gland. And that's where you get an increase in the size of the gland, which surrounds the bit of the urethra that goes through it.
And this happens in about a third of men over the age of 50 and about 90% of men over the age of 80. Prostate cancer is another disease that affects the prostate, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later in a little bit more detail. The early symptoms in that are again related to enlargement, and so they can be quite similar to the symptoms you get in benign prostatic hypertrophy, or BPH, because of the pressure effects.
And we're going to talk about the management of these conditions all later on. We're going to talk about what they are first and then the management later.
So prostatitis is another thing that we don't see all that often, but it's quite important to know about. It's an acute issue. It's one of the few acute things. And it's usually due to an infection or an inflammation of the prostate. It generally happens in younger men in sort of between the age of 30 and 50. They can get pain on passing urine, on pain on ejaculation associated with fevers. And it can also be one of the kind of hidden sources of infection. So quite often they'll have sort of these lower urinary tract symptoms. It will be presumed to be a UTI, but actually to think about it might be the prostate, because it's just so local that the symptoms can be quite similar.
So let's think about some of the symptoms that you would get in bladder outflow obstruction, so prostatic enlargement. And within the lower urinary tract symptoms, we split them in two. We talk about voiding LUTs and storage LUTs. So voiding LUTs are due to a problem with the flow of urine through the tubes. And so the voiding symptoms are difficulty of passing urine from the bladder to the outer world. So the first thing that you see, or the first symptom I think about, is hesitancy. So people feel the need to go to the loo, they get to the toilet, and then they can't go. It takes a while to start. Then when the wee starts to come, it doesn't flow so well. It doesn't. A consultant I used to work for used to ask people if it hit the porcelain like it used to, could they still pee up the wall? Which is sometimes a good way of thinking about it. Sometimes people have to strain to go to the loo. They have difficulty emptying the bladder. And then when they want to finish, it doesn't just turn off. It carries on dribbling afterwards, and it's called terminal dribbling.
And then there's the storage symptoms. So these storage really means the bladder, that's where the urine is being stored, and may relate to either urinary retention, so not being able to get urine out of the bladder, or well, there might be symptoms of overactive bladder, so the bladder wanting to empty when it doesn't really need to. But again, we've talked a lot about these in our urinary continence episode, and Ian, as could be predicted, has a mnemonic for this.
Yeah, well, these are the fun symptoms,
although
but they're not.
Not really that fun.
But F for frequency. So frequency during the day. U is for urgency. So you can't wait. You have to go straight away. And N is for nocturia, which is frequent passing of urine at night.
So alongside taking a history, there are some investigations that can support the evaluation, which will be quite common to some of you. So we're just going to do a short bit of instruction to those. So one is a urine dipstick or a MSU to evaluate for a potential infection. Another is an abdominal examination to look for signs of retention, which is usually a fullness and a dullness suprapubically, so just at the bottom of the tummy. And this should really include a digital rectal examination to look for the size and contour of the prostate, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. We can also ask people to do a bladder diary so you can get a good idea of how often they're going to the toilet and the volumes that they're expelling. And also thinking about using a validated symptom score, for example, the IPSS, which is the International Prostate Symptom Score, to establish a baseline for their symptoms so that you can get a more objective assessment of whether their symptoms have changed with any treatments that you might choose.
And then you may want to do some other investigations, such as a renal function on blood tests, a cystoscopy to look inside the bladder, an ultrasound scan of the bladder and the kidneys looking from the outside in, a post-void residual volume, which I think is really important. So after someone's had a wee, you then measure the amount of urine in the bladder. And then sometimes urodynamics, which are flow rate measurements, but often you don't need to do those unless you've got specific concerns about them being something
else
going on.
So those would probably be a urologist deciding about those. So next we're going to talk about PSA testing, which a lot of you will have heard about and has some controversy around it. I think it's quite important to understand what it is because it's a common question that people might have, or if they've had the test, in understanding. So the idea of this section is to make you feel more confident about having that conversation with people who may be about to have it or have had it and don't know what to do with it. And it's also a bit of a lead-in to an episode that we're going to do later in the series on cancers in older adults. And as we heard in my social media thing earlier, it can lead to overdiagnosis. So it's to give you a bit more confidence with that. So what is PSA?
So it's a protein that liquefies semen and occurs at low levels in normal situations. And it is only really produced from the prostate. And so it can be used as a tumour marker to identify potential prostate cancers. As you've alluded to, it's not perfect.
No, and it stands for prostate-specific antigen, as you said.
It does indeed.
It's only produced by the prostate. So the problems with the test.
So you can get a false negative rate, and that's about 15%. So that means for 100 negative results, 15 men will have a prostate cancer that you miss.
On the flip side, it has a false positive rate of 75%, meaning that for every 100 positive results, 75 of those will not actually have a prostate cancer. So it's quite imperfect, isn't it, in both directions, really.
Yeah. But a raised PSA increases the likelihood of you having a prostate cancer and therefore may allow an early diagnosis and therefore earlier investigation and treatment. But as you said, it may also lead to over-investigation and morbidities associated with that.
Both psychologically and physically,
of
the treatments.
And your normal range for PSA changes depending on how old the person you're looking after is. So if you're under the age of 70, an abnormal PA is anything over 3. If you're between 70 and 80, it's normal for it to be slightly higher, so an abnormal PSA is over 5.
Interestingly, there's no reference range defined or validated for men over the age of 80. If the PSA is under 10, there's about a 20% chance of prostate cancer. Still. But if the PSA is over 10, there's about a 50% chance of prostate cancer. So there is a correlation with the number. So it's not just a pure positive or negative test.
What it often means is that a raised PSA, unless you can think of a reason why it would be raised, and we'll talk about them next, leads on to further investigations to try and exclude cancer or malignancy in the prostate.
Yeah. And that's where it can lead to potential harms or unnecessary worry for people who don't. So there are some other causes of a raised PSA, and these include a prostatitis. So it's released by the prostate. So if there's an inflammation there, then you are going to release that out into the circulation. Benign prostatic hypertension. So BPH can be associated with a raised level of PSA.
Prostate's just got larger. It's going to make more PSA.
Yeah. If you've had a recent UTI, again, because of the inflammation that's been around there, recent catheterisation or ejaculation, and it also rises with age as part of a normal process.
You would do a PSA if someone has lower urinary tract symptoms suggestive of bladder outflow obstruction, so the voiding symptoms, if they had an abnormal feeling prostate when it's been examined, or if they or you are concerned about prostate cancer for another reason.
And the guidance is that we should counsel patients on doing it using some of those numbers above and to give them some written information to decide what they would like to do. So as we said, though, there is quite a clear correlation with prostate cancer, which could be identified early. Who would we 2-week wait, which is the kind of rapid cancer referrals to urology? And the answer to that is any patients with lower urinary tract symptoms but no evidence of a urinary tract infection, who also have a raised PSA, any raised PSA result, and any abnormal feeling prostate on digital rectal examination, which does mean a lot of men are going to go through this process. Uh-huh. So next we're going to talk a little bit about screening, which is quite an interesting topic. And I think prostate cancer is one of those areas where this has been quite controversial, hasn't it? There's been quite a lot of debate about whether we should be screening people who don't have any symptoms to identify potential cancers early.
Yeah, and the evidence doesn't support screening at the moment due to the risks and morbidity associated with the investigation process.
Yeah.
And potentially over-treatment of the raised PSAs that are not malignant.
So important things to understand are that prostate cancer mortality is significantly reduced over a 13 period. So when diagnosing people with prostate cancer, you need to make 27 new diagnoses to avoid one death.
Prostate cancer is common. There are just over 41,000 new diagnoses per year. It's present in about 1% of men under the age of 50. And 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed in their lifetime as having prostate cancer, with 80% of 80-year-olds having some form of cancer cells in their prostate. It's more common in the Black African population, who have a risk of 1 in 4 during their lifetime. And your risk is also increased if you have a family history with a first-degree relative. So that'd be your father or your son, I guess. And if you're smoking or if you're overweight, that also increases the risk.
Mm. The interesting thing is looking at the natural history of prostate cancers, and this remains quite unclear. There are several different stages. So the first is initiation, so you see abnormal cells in the prostate. The second is diagnosis by screening, so they're asymptomatic, but you find abnormal blood tests. Third is diagnosis by clinical symptoms, so once they've developed pressure symptoms, so lower urinary tract symptoms. And then fourthly is clinically detectable metastatic disease. So, for example, a common place that prostate cancer will go to is bones.
And the treatment and management is difficult due to the broad spectrum of the disease, and that's defined really by the rate of tumour growth. So you can have slow-growing, relatively insignificant tumours, which the majority of those 80% of 80-year-old men will have, and people are asymptomatic from it, and they're unlikely to progress or require any form of treatment, versus some types of prostate cancer are quite rapidly growing, clinically very significant, and have great degree of potential to progress rapidly and metastasise, as you said, particularly to bone.
And it doesn't seem to be known why some tumours are more aggressive, and the PSAs don't really reflect that or indicate which will be which. So a PSA negative tumour can still be quite aggressive.
Yeah, and the net result of that is that 93% of patients diagnosed with a prostate cancer will be alive at 1 year, and 81% will be alive at 5 years.
Which, compared to some other cancers, is really very high.
Yeah, and especially since you're generally dealing with an older age group anyway, and so there is going to be other
mortality
comorbidities associated with that.
Yeah. Compare that with people who have prostate cancer with metastatic disease. 50% are alive at 3 years and 30% at 5 years. So there's a real divergence in the clinical patterns seen. So this is an example of where cancers can be split into those two kinds, dependent on the effect that they have on that person who's living with it. So some people who have a slow-growing prostate cancer might be considered alongside other chronic diseases. So, for example, a condition that a person lives with, which may cause some symptoms and may require some treatment, but they are more likely to die with rather than as a direct consequence of, as opposed to the other types of cancer, which without treatment, such as chemotherapy or radiotherapy or surgery, will almost certainly progress and spread and cause physical deterioration and ultimately death. And increasingly, there are cancers which can be well controlled which are now being considered by oncologists as more akin to chronic disease. So I think it's an important distinction to kind of understand. So for example, 4% of deaths in men are from prostate cancer, but the prevalence in over 80s, as we said, is around 80%. In the main, they don't die of this.
So when people have prostate cancer,
mm-hmm.
treatments can be chemotherapy,
mm-hmm.
they can be radiotherapy, or they can be surgery. And one of the surgical options is what's called a radical prostatectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a study of radical prostatectomy versus just observing people for local spread that didn't show any difference in mortality over the 12-year of the study. And given the high prevalence of prostate cancer in those people over 80, without an impact on mortality, there is a thought that maybe prostate cancer only needs to be diagnosed if it's likely to need treatment.
Hmm. One important thing to consider if you are looking after or working with someone who has had a prostatectomy for prostate cancer is the differences of if they develop incontinence following that procedure, which is different to if they hadn't had that. So I think this is quite important if you're a nurse working with someone and they come to you with this, or a doctor, that you recognise that this is managed differently. So about 40% of people who have had a prostatectomy have incontinence afterwards, and about 10% of them will require further surgery to manage their incontinence rather than the usual medical and conservative measures.
And they get incontinence because you're operating around the bladder neck and the sphincter, and you can cause damage to the sphincter.
Yeah, so typically it will be a kind of stress incontinence that they describe. Some will have some overactivity of the bladder as well, and they can be managed as you would normally manage someone with overactive bladder. With the stress incontinence side of things, initially they should be offered usual treatments, so pelvic floor training for 3 months. But if that fails, then you would need to think about asking someone to refer them back to urology for assessment, because there are some specific surgical treatments they can offer.
And those sort of things are bulking injections around the periurethral area, adjustable balloon systems. So you put a balloon that sits at the bladder outlet that can have water added and then taken from it to help maintain the continence. Urethral slings, I guess an analogous way that is used in stress incontinence in women.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, more recently, artificial urethral sphincters. They're probably the most efficacious. But if someone has an artificial urethral sphincter and they're in retention, please don't try and catheterise them.
And the reason is that to get past that sphincter, you need to deflate it down. So a urologist needs to do that, so don't attempt it.
Okay. So let's move on now and leave the world of prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go back a step and think about those people who have non-cancer-related bladder outflow obstruction.
Yes.
And the commonest cause for that would be benign prostatic hypertrophy.
Mm.
So this is an enlargement in the size of the prostate gland from that walnut size to something larger. And as that happens, it causes a constriction or a pressing on the urethra that flows through it.
Now, in lots of the things that we talk about conservative measures first. Actually, this is one of those areas where actually it's medications first. So if you identify someone with these symptoms, then redirect them to someone who can prescribe if you can't.
Yeah. And the first type of medications are alpha blockers.
Mm-hmm.
So some common ones are tamsulosin or doxazosin or alfluosin. And they work to relax the muscles at the bladder neck. And they work quite well.
Yes.
They need to be taken for a little while, but they work quite well.
Mm.
But they do have side effects. Doxazosin is also an antihypertensive.
Mm.
So they cause a low blood pressure. And sometimes a significant postural blood pressure change.
something that we never really think about in doxazosin is that it's relaxing the bladder neck and quite often then causes incontinence, which patients won't tell you about. So if you see someone on that as well, women as well, that's the mechanism of action. So quite often they'll develop incontinence afterwards and not put two and two together and also not tell you. It's worth looking out for.
And therefore, keep an eye on these people. So see them 4 to 6 weeks after starting the medication and then every 6 months to yearly after that.
And the other group of medications we commonly use are called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, so things like finasteride, and they help to physically shrink the size of the prostate. They're best used in men who have got quite large prostates and people who are at high risk of progression. They take much longer to work than alpha blockers, so they take sort of long weeks to months to really kick in, whereas the alpha blockers will work within a few days and early weeks. With this group of medications, you would want to be reviewing them after about 3 to 6 months and then again every sort of 6 to 12 months to see what benefit you're having.
Yeah. And you can use both together sometimes, particularly people who've got moderate to severe LUTs and you think they've probably got a larger prostate, so their PSA is slightly raised but not at a level you want to go and investigate it further.
So as we said earlier, low urinary tract symptoms in men are not entirely due to prostate, but they do account the majority. One of the things you'd want to be reviewing is they've started their alpha blocker for LUTs or whatever they're starting. If they still have ongoing storage symptoms, so things like urgency, nocturia and frequency, then you might want to go on and treat them as though they're an overactive bladder as well. So maybe adding in an anticholinergic or some of the other conservative measures that we discussed in the previous episode.
But you'd want to make sure that you're keeping an eye on their post-void residual volumes and you're not pushing them into retention from the anticholinergics.
Yes. So people who don't respond to these treatments or are unable to tolerate the treatments, for example, if they have quite problematic postural hypotension, they can be considered for more invasive treatments such as catheters or surgery. And decisions around that should really be guided by how the symptoms are impacting their quality of life.
You can do surgery for benign prostatic hypertrophy, and it's very well evidence-based and it's very effective and very commonly done. It's usually a transurethral surgery. And that's what's called the TURPS, transurethral resection of the prostate. And there are lots of different techniques using lasers or diathermy or various different things. And sometimes an open procedure is needed for larger prostates.
So people who are being considered for surgery will be seen by a urologist and they will have some extra investigations, usually to help evaluate the impact of the anatomy on function to make sure that the surgery is going to be of benefit. So some of those things we talked about before, the urodynamics are looking at the urine flow rate, measuring post-void residual volumes. They might do a cystoscopy, which is a camera up into the bladder if the symptoms are quite severe, and renal ultrasound if there's chronic retention to see if there's been any back pressure to the kidneys. The surgery is not insignificant, though.
You have to have a general anaesthetic. It would require a short, normally sort of the same day or overnight hospital stay. You can get bleeding, and so people often, they may have a blood loss, but also they will need bladder irrigation after the surgery for a little while to ensure that, or to try and reduce the risk of hematuria and urinary retention you can get from the hematuria.
So thinking about people who are quite high risk for delirium, actually that might be a little bit too much for them to go through, especially having the catheter and lots of irrigation go through it, the hospital admission itself. And if people have got significant other medical comorbidities, the general anaesthetic might be too much for a risk as well. Mm. So those are the things that you really consider in deciding whether that's a treatment option for that person.
And discuss that with them and sort of weigh up those risks.
And then just for our last bit, we're going to talk a bit about urinary retention and the use of catheters. So urinary retention can be because the prostate is so large that you're no longer able to pass urine out, and this can be acute or chronic.
Yeah, and it's when you want to pass urine and you can't, and you've got a significant volume in the bladder, so usually more than sort of 350 mils upwards.
Yeah. So acute urinary retention, as the title would describe, happens quite quickly. This is usually very, very painful. Those people should be catheterised quickly and then started on alpha blocker and then plan to have the catheter taken out once they're established on the alpha blocker. So once that drug has had a chance to kick in, then you take the catheter out safely.
Chronic retention is something that by its nature is built up over a longer period of time. The volumes that people can retain can sometimes be quite large, over a litre of urine.
Yeah.
Often they're not painful, but they can have a pressure effect back to the kidneys and you can develop a hydronephrosis. So they need an ultrasound scan after you fix the retention to look at that. If someone's bladder is stretched to that large amount and you catheterise it, it's unlikely the bladder will work completely normally afterwards. It's a bit like a spring. If you've if you've pulled it and let go of it, which is like acute retention, it'll work again. But if you've pulled it way, way too far, it's not going to spring back as normally.
And a rule of thumb would be if you've got a litre in the bladder, that's never acute because it had to stretch over a long time.
Yeah.
If there's renal impairment on the blood tests that's related to the chronic urinary retention, then the recommendation is to catheterise that person to try and alleviate the pressure on the kidneys, although someone might have renal impairment for another reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guidance is to ideally use intermittent self-catheterisation or carer-administered intermittent catheterisation as an option before inserting an indwelling catheter. I have to say, probably for our patient group in the main, that's too impractical. And so we don't use that very often. But it is recommended that we consider that at least first. And you should consider whether surgery can be used as a definitive treatment. And if it's not, and intermittent self-catheterisation is not an option, then to use a long-term catheter.
Yeah.
And quite often I think we jump to the end there.
I think you're very right. Often we do jump to long-term catheters when actually we should explore intermittent self-catheterisation a little bit and see whether or not there are surgical options for how we can manage people. But if someone does have a long-term catheter, there are benefits of that sometimes, in that you obviously relieving the obstruction, relieving the problems that can be associated with the pressure, back pressure through the kidneys. But it comes with risks. You can get damage to the penis itself, particularly the urethral tears if the catheter is being pulled on or gets caught on some clothing or bed sheets. You can develop hematuria or have prostate trauma from the catheter, which can then make putting subsequent catheters in much more difficult. You can have urinary tract infections associated with catheters, and 75% of urinary tract infections in inpatients are associated with catheters. And on average, someone with a long-term catheter will have 1 to 2 infections per year.
You can get bladder spasms, so just because you have a catheter in doesn't necessarily stop the bladder trying to expel, and that can still be quite painful, and so a catheter may not actually improve the symptoms of urgency that people have. If you pick the wrong size of catheter, you might get a leakage around. It can be associated with an increased prevalence of bladder stones as well. And again, if you have the wrong size, it can be associated with urethral stenosis and internal pressure damage, which is under-recognised, I think. So, in summary, you should consider a long-term catheter if medical management has failed and surgery is not appropriate, and they are unable to manage an intermittent self-catheter, which would be the preferred option. Another reason to consider it would be skin wounds or pressure ulcers that need protecting and keeping clean, or if they're quite distressed by needing to change clothes and being wet in the bed.
So if you've got any thoughts about that, please contribute to the Twitter chat using the hashtag MDTClub, or send us your comments via Twitter at MDT_podcast, or on facebook.com/MDTpodcast, or via the website, which is
www.hearingaidpodcast.org.uk, where you can find a CPD log where we will send you an automatic copy for your revalidation and self-reflection CPD. You can find all of our show notes with references to all the things we've been talking about, downloadable infographics, the social media things that we've been talking about.
And the gallery entry
later on.
And the gallery.
Yeah.
The MDT Podcast.
It is time for the MDT-ter.
Yes.
This is a catchily titled MDT item guessing game. And we're going to describe a visual catchphrase to each other. And please guess along, and then we have one for you.
I'm very proud of mine this week.
Okie doke, I'm quite proud of mine.
Competition.
Do you want to start then?
No, you go first this time.
Okay. So this is a brown box wrapped up in brown paper with string around it. The string is undone, and out of the box comes a flannel. And then out of the box comes a sandwich. Then out of the box comes a ready meal. Then out of the box comes a set of pyjamas. And then out of the box comes someone dressed in uniform with a badge that says, "Hello, I'm your carer."
Care package.
Yes.
Yes.
Or package of care. Yes.
Amazing. Package of care, yeah, cool. All right, are you ready for mine?
Yep, no.
Are you ever, though? Okay. So there's three parts to this, each on top of each other. So on the top, there is a road sign for a hospital. On the bottom, there is the number 8. And dividing the two is a set of scales. So you have to put those together and then work out what the thing is.
That's it.
Yeah.
So a hospital over scales over 8.
No, there's a road sign for a hospital road sign on top.
Okay.
And then underneath it is the number 8. And dividing the two is a set of scales.
Is the 8 of relevance?
Could yes.
It just be any number? No, it's specifically 8.
Specifically 8. This is a very well thought out one.
I fear it may be too thought out. 8. What has 8? 8 legs? Spiders have 8 legs? No.
Think about how they would be written down.
8. Sign. Scale 8.
Realised I did this wrong.
I don't know. I don't know. What is it?
It was BMI. So weight divided by height. But I realised that when I did it, that I described it as height divided by weight, which is not helpful. So the weight was the scales.
Yes.
And you had the sign for the hospital was a H because it's a road sign. And then 8. So written down that is height divided by scales, which is weight. But then I realised I did it the wrong way around.
That's a bit obscure. It's good, though. Good, good. Okay, so we've got one for you. If you head on down to our Twitter feed, which is at @MDT_podcast, have a look at the image pinned to the Twitter feed and send us your guesses using the hashtag MDTeaser. The first correct guess of this one will win a MDT mug, much coveted.
And don't forget to join in with our MDT chat using the hashtag MDT Club, which is run by Dan Thomas, a geriatrics registrar up in Liverpool.
And now it's time for the gallery. I have a poem from Alison Bolas, who works with the Alzheimer's Society and is a lady who has been diagnosed with relatively young onset dementia and has been happy for us to use her poems. This is called Faltering. Faltering. Stumbling, I reach for the letters that I use to employ with delight to define me, explain me, to justify me. My tools, my craft, some light touch here, some emphasis there, just might strike a chord. Letters sliding down the stairs of poesy and hoping for a soft landing, tiptoeing around my soul. But now the words rebel. They sense my growing decline. They note the hesitation in my clichés. All is not well in the world of verse. All is not well in my mind. The shuffling, suffering decline has a beat of its own. I'm not sure I want to move to it. Not yet. I have the strength to hold back. There is joy to have and love to have. Sod my nemesis. It can wait in the rings until I am ready. There may be trouble ahead, but I can still be happy for now.
The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a Hearing Aid Podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.